And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from VBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Todd Rundgren was inspired by virtuoso trendsetters Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Michael Bloomfield, and Harvey Mandel. The Philly native directed his creativities into launching the bands Money and Woody's Truck Stop, achieving regional success. Rundgren then organized the nationally recognized NAS in 1967. Initially formed as a psychedelic blues rock band, it discovered an array of eclectic music styles. Todd Rundgren's huge hit, Hello, It's Me, was originally recorded with the NAS in 1968. The NAS became successful with the psychedelic tune Open My Eyes while opening shows for Jim Morrison and The Doors. After NAS broke up, Rundgren recorded several solo albums under the name Runt, and Todd scored commercially with his first big solo hit, We Gotta Get You a Woman, in 1971. The genius of Rundgren became even clearer with the release of his certified gold double album masterpiece, Something, Anything. The album spawned the huge top 40 singles, I Saw the Light, and NAS original composition, Hello, It's Me, which reached number 5 on Billboard. Utopia was formed in 1973, but the band's foundation was established in 74. Rundgren magnified his musical inventiveness by fusing progressive pop, psychedelic, and hard rock into euphonious orchestrations. Utopia's signature anthem, Just One Victory, from the 1973 release A Wizard, A True Star, is usually played at the end of every concert. Rundgren's penned Love is the Answer from Utopia's Oops, Wrong Planet album in 1977 became a huge hit for England Dan and John Ford Coley in 1979, reaching number 10 on the Billboard's Hot 100 charts. Todd Rundgren maintained a highly successful solo career while recording and performing with Utopia. In 1978, Rundgren released his sentimental Can We Still Be Friends on Billboard and became number 29 on Billboard's Hot 100. Throughout the 70s and 80s, Todd Rundgren established himself as an industrious musical genius at the recording studio, producing and engineering for legendary artists, including classic albums Straight Up by Badfinger, Stage Fright by the band The New York Dolls, We're an American Band and Shining On by Grand Funk Railroad, Bad Out of Hell by Meatloaf, and Skylarking by XTC. Rundgren also contributed his extraordinary skills as a first-rate musician and composer to a legion of legendary artists. 1983, Todd Rundgren wrote Bang the Drum All Day. All the instruments on the song were performed by Rundgren. The tune is widely heard at professional sporting events around the country and used on TV commercials and movie trailers. Rundgren continues to perform with Ringo Starr and his all-star band, and Rundgren recently released his critically acclaimed album, White Night, on May 12th via Cleopatra Records. The 15-track collection features a dynamic range of original songs and deft studio work by Rundgren with an impressive array of what he terms collaborators, including Damn Funk, Donald Fagen, Daryl Hall, Trent Reznor, and Atticus Ross of Nine Inch Nails, Joe Satriani, and Joe Walsh, to name just a few. The album is available to purchase now at Amazon.com. Please welcome to the Ray Shasho Show, legendary musical innovator, musician, singer, composer, multi-instrumentalist, record producer, engineer, Todd Rundgren. Hello, Todd.
I'm exhausted.
So am I. Well, that's your life story. I guess we're done.
Yeah, that's what I mean. What's left to tell? I don't
know. What's left to tell, right? The last time we chatted, you were at your home in Hawaii, and we were talking about the Utopia reunion, which came to Florida, and we were talking about, I think you were performing at the Capitol Theater, in which you also perform at the Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater all the time. We appreciate that, by the way.
Ruth Eckert is a pretty regular stop for us. So, that was an interesting sort of exercise. It was not literally a Utopia reunion, although we had a lot of the guys who had played on the original records participate, but it was kind of fomented by a benefit that we had for one of our original members, Moogie Klingman, who was having health issues, and we had only intended to get together for like a couple of shows in New York City, but we had a good time, and Moogie in particular, you know, wanted to go further with it. And unfortunately, by the time we got together, which was almost a year later, I guess, to go out, Moogie had gotten too ill to actually come out on the tour. So it was a somewhat bittersweet, I guess, reunion, because, you know, we had hoped to have as many of the original members as possible, and could only get, let's say, a quorum to do it.
Yeah. It was a great show, nevertheless. It was an awesome show.
Well, you know, if you're into that kind of music, it holds up pretty good.
Yep.
It was certainly a challenge for some of us, because we hadn't played it, much of it, in years and years. And
that's right.
Some of the guys had actually, you know, they still played, but they didn't tour. And so that was a new thing for them, once again, to actually get back out on the road.
You know, your Philly accent is getting more prominent in your older years.
It is?
Yes, it is.
Oh, you should hear my sisters.
Oh, really? Is that right?
Oh, yeah, they talk like this, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you've got three different concert tours going on, man. You've got White Knight. You've been working on the solo concert, which is awesome. You've got your tour with Yes and Carl Palmer's ELP, Legacy, which I just interviewed Carl not that long ago. And then Ringo and his All-Star Band, beginning, I guess, in the fall. And you're not tired?
Well, I'm actually on break right now. But I've been enjoying my time on the road. We've gotten it down to something of a routine, I guess.
Right.
And the shows, this show, the last show that we've been doing in particular, seem to be, at least for me, fairly easy to get through. You know, sometimes I have shows that are really a lot of work.
Right.
But this particular one, either because of the pacing or because of the fact that there are little breaks throughout when I do costume changes, actually, I felt, you know, pretty good doing the shows. Mm-hmm. And when we go out with on the Yestable, we're actually only playing about an hour or so, maybe a little bit longer than an hour. So that's down from the 2 hours that the show usually runs. So I'm getting a break there. I'm working half as hard when we do that. And then when I go out with Ringo, I only have to do three songs of my own, although I do caper about quite a bit on the Ringo show, so that keeps you busy. But, I started out, I guess, with what would be the hardest thing, which is my own show, in which I play two hours straight. And then everything after that gets a little bit easier. And then at the end of the year, I'm going to go out again with the White Knight type show. And
oh, good.
That'll be back up to 2 hours a night of playing.
Yeah, that's a heck of a production. You got the band behind you. I guess they're not, you know, you got the screen in back of you, which, like, it's like a TV thing, and all kinds of wild stuff is going on there while you're singing. It's really neat. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it was a pretty unique kind of setup, somewhat experimental, and incredibly expensive to take around.
Really?
And took a long time. It takes a long time to put up. The crew gets in at 8 in the morning for a show. Mm-hmm. That's essentially 12 hours later. So we're going to be doing, we don't have the luxury of taking that out during the estival because there's not enough time to change the stage
right.
over.
Right.
And when we do go out again in on a little holiday tour between Thanksgiving and New Year's, we're going to try and do something that's a little bit easier to set up. It's not only difficult for us, it's difficult sometimes for the promoters because, you know, we have to pay a crew from starting at 8 in the morning
right.
until the whole set gets torn down, which is sometime around midnight or 1 a.m. So that's a long time to keep a crew around.
Yeah. You know, I give those guys a lot of credit through the years, you know, breaking down, setting up. I mean, that's tedious work, and they do it every day, you know, on tour. It's
you really have to have the temperament for it, you know, aside
yeah.
from obviously a necessary skill set. But
right.
It's a different kind of lifestyle, and, you know, some grow to prefer
yep.
it. But me, I have to have a certain number of hours of sleep a night, or I can't do my part
mm-hmm.
of the show. But these
right.
guys sometimes go for days at a time just grabbing naps here and there.
Right.
So it definitely takes, you know, a kind of a temperament and a stamina to do a show like we're doing, which is, you know,
mm-hmm.
more than simply setting up the drums and plugging
right.
in the amplifiers. It's a whole ordeal, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. White Knight, I gave it 5 stars, if you don't mind. It's an awesome album.
I don't mind.
This is what today's music is supposed to sound like and should be played on mainstream radio. This is the stuff that should be on mainstream radio. You know, and I absolutely hate it when great new music is ignored and not played on the radio, on you know, mainstream anyway. It just bothers the hell out of me. I used to be a DJ back in the late 70s. I did Top 40 radio, so it really irks me. You know?
Yeah, well, you also probably lived through the era of syndication, you know, when, you know, the local program directors and DJs lost all control over what got
I know.
Played. You know, it all got dictated out of L.A. somewhere or something like that.
Right.
You will play these 25 songs in this specific rotation,
mm-hmm.
and you're essentially just there to, you know, to follow that list and
right.
fill in, you know, in between, just tell everybody who they just heard, you know, that sort
Horrible.
Of thing. So I remember growing up in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
you know, and into the early 70s, which was kind of the halcyon days of radio, because...
Right.
There was so much stuff to be played. There were so many different genres that were popular at the time, and the local DJ and the local program director had complete discretion to play whatever they wanted. So you might hear, like, you would hear the Beatles, and then you would hear Judy Collins, and then
yeah.
you would hear Bill Evans, you know? It would be like,
yeah, and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, it would be just
you know?
The craziest mix of genres and artists, you know, and that's what made radio fun, because you never knew what you were going to hear next.
Maybe they shouldn't have got rid of payola. Maybe that was
yeah,
a good
well,
thing.
That's one way to get music played, you know, but
yeah.
it's funny, the music industry has evolved into this kind of other thing. It quite obviously goes through phases, but this is
yeah.
kind of like unlike any other phase in which I can't remember another era in which women so dominated pop music.
It's true.
You know, all of the
yep.
all of the biggest earners in pop music
mm-hmm.
are like Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and Adele and people like that. They're the ones that are, you know, selling the most concert tickets and the most records. And as long as they continue to do that, I suppose that's the way the record industry will continue to operate. I think it may have a lot to do with, you know, where the disposable income is and what
but
it
you
gets
know, they're,
spent
they're,
on.
They're missing a whole – I mean, they're missing the guys. The guys are the ones that used to buy the albums, you know.
Yeah, but the guys aren't
day.
Listening to music as much as they used to.
No,
you know,
they're not.
The guys
you're
are
right.
spending – The guys are spending that money on other things like video games or something.
Right.
You know, they're playing Grand Theft Auto instead of listening to music now. So the entire, you know, the sweet spot of, you know, yeah, of the audience is essentially teenage girls with disposable income, and they want to hear Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and Adele and that sort of stuff.
I'm so sick of that crap.
until that underlying phenomenon changes, until, like, guys get more interested in music.
Yep.
And at this point, you know, I'm not sure why they should. I went to Coachella for the first time. I'd never been to Coachella before. And I heard that it was supposed to be this real wild, kind of almost bohemian scene. But it turned out to be anything but that. It seemed like there were just all of these wandering groups of women who may have been there to hear the music, but more likely there to hook up with the wandering groups of beer-besotted men. Kind of like,
really?
It didn't seem like most people were there so much because there was a band they really, really wanted to see, so much as an opportunity to hook up. And the music was there as a pretext for that.
Guys like cool dudes. They like cool guys, cool performers. You know, that's why we like the Robert Plants and the Jim Morrisons and the Todd Rundgrens. And, you know, we thought they were cool. That's why we bought the albums, and we love their music. And there
isn't
anybody cool
anymore. Not so many of those, I guess, anymore. You know, a lot of the...
Yeah.
You know, there was the era of the so-called grunge, you know, went into the 90s and stuff like that, and that was kind of attractive to guys. You would find more guys, for instance, in a Nirvana audience than you would girls.
Right.
And the same may be said for, say, like a band like Foo Fighters. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of, you know, they're legacy bands now. You know,
that's
acts that came together in the 90s. It's 20 years on now, you know.
I think that was the end of somewhat of a rock and roll period. I think is back.
Yeah,
in that
well,
day,
a,
fun, you know?
A funny thing happened. You know, a lot of it has to do with the penetration of the internet and the fact that most people have decided to get their music, you know, through virtual channels as opposed to going to a record store like HMV or something like that and having a little shopping spree and buying CDs. And the music has become ephemeral, and the way that it gets promoted is equally ephemeral. So the phenomenon of internet penetration it's changed things a lot. You know, we went through a whole phase of, and it's still there, it has an effect on other kinds of music, but the whole EDM thing that happened, where the artist, where it was no longer even bands, it's a guy in his bedroom, you know, it's Skrillex, you know, Skrillex just sitting at his desk, you know, making all of this, you know, this really aggressive and kind of... almost sound effects kind of records, you know, that get played a lot at festivals. So there's this whole other category of artists who, you know, you don't really hear much of them, but you hear their influence, and they make all of their money playing big events where people go to almost more to kind of like dance and mosh around than they do to specifically listen to the music. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the days.
Yeah,
just,
you know,
just
as I say, that's all. You know, a lot of this is, you know, part of the way that the internet has changed things. You know, we haven't been able to fully measure the entire impact on music, as well as the impact on politics and all other facets of life. But you know, it's starting to reveal itself in the fact that certain artists. There are artists now who never sell their music. They only sell concert tickets and merchandise, which is actually a more foundational model than kind of the 100 years of the music business in which people thought they could make a living just making records.
Todd, I covered John Mayall in his 80th birthday, which was here in Sarasota, and he was just standing out there, you know, trying to sell his latest CD. And he was setting up his own equipment, you know.
Yeah, still playing. You know, it's
still
funny. I might have met John Mayall a long time ago, but didn't really have much association with him. And I did one of these rock cruises in January.
Right.
And he was also on the bill, and I got to sit in with him. And it was like, you know, kind of the thrill of my lifetime, because there was John Mayall doing All Your Love, and here mm-hmm. was I was Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was my guitar idol, because I was playing...
Awesome.
I was playing, you know, a song from, you know, that Blues Breakers album that was so influential, mm-hmm. and I was on stage with John Mayall playing it, and it was just, you know, it's thrilling, like the first time I played with Ringo. So
that's incredible.
Yeah,
you
he's
and Ringo
still doing it. He's still great.
Yeah.
I know, you know, we got to be friends with the guys in his band, and mm-hmm. They've actually come to visit us out here in Kauai recently. So, yeah, big ups for John.
Yeah, he's a good guy, too. I got to hang with him backstage, and he had his birthday cake there. And he, very nice man. Very, very nice man.
He's essentially one of these guys who's not simply a musician. He's
right.
A musician's musician, because he's introduced the world to so many other players.
That's right.
You know, to Art Clapton and Peter Green and, you know, a whole sort of lineage of guitar players as well as other players. So, you know, he still is an ambassador for, you know, a music genre that kind of floats in and out of the public consciousness,
right.
You know,
yeah.
But he is a blues player.
Yeah, to me, he's got that legend like a Pete Seeger, you know. He just stands out there as one of those guys.
Well, you know, that is the tradition of the blues. You know, you don't
yeah.
retire. You
right,
play and
right.
You play until you just can't play anymore.
Your album, yeah. I love the guys, the collaboration you have. I know they weren't actually in the studio with you. They was kind of remotely, right? And then you put it all together, because you're such a genius at doing that. It's amazing.
Well, it is another advantage that has accrued to the, you know, the fact that internet accessibility is now pretty universal, and
hey, you must love this technology, man.
Yeah, and also yeah. it's pretty high speed as well. Like, you know,
right?
The idea of moving gigabytes around on a dial-up modem, you know, is kind of ludicrous. But you know, nowadays, you know, we've all got, you know, pretty robust connectivity, so you can send,
yep.
you know, gigantic files of stuff back and forth to people. And often it doesn't, you know, in the process like this, every once in a while, we have to send the entire project, you know, 24
right.
or however many tracks of sound there are on the project.
Right.
But it's also possible for me to just send, like, an MP3 of a song with no vocal on it and have somebody sing over top of it, and that's pretty easily done as well. So
that's pretty neat.
There are a lot of ways to, you know, to break down this particular problem, but yeah, it wouldn't have been possible, let's say, even maybe 10 or 15 years ago, because not mm-hmm. everybody had the connectivity to do it.
Well, the albums, you know, like every one of your albums, extremely well produced. You know, it's very, very clear. It's incredible. I just want to go over a couple of tracks with you real quick.
Sure.
I'm very impressed. You know, Naked and Afraid, you got Betty LaVette. I don't know if a lot of people know her background, but Betty, I mean, she played with Otis Redding, man, and James Brown, and she's been around a long time.
She's developed this, you know, this sort of approach to music that's kind of like, you know, take no prisoners. She finds a song that she feels comfortable with, she kind of gets inside it in a mm-hmm. way that makes it completely her song. So, you know, you might be hearing, she, you know, the first time I met her, we were doing a Beatles tribute at the Hollywood Bowl.
Right.
And she sang Blackbird. And it took
oh, really?
You, like, a couple verses for you to even recognize the song.
Mm-hmm.
She had so transformed it into, you know, something more personal to her. So that's the way that she has kind of characterized herself, and maybe a reason why more people don't know who she is. Because she's never had any
yeah.
interest in just going out and making singles or doing
yep.
that kind of thing. She got kind of, somewhat screwed over by the music business very early on and made a decision just to make her own way and to never sell out. And that's what makes her so great and such a incredible performer to see, because very few people kind of own the material the way that she does.
Well, thank you for recognizing that and putting her on your album. Incredible.
No, she's a great person. I've done a lot of events with her since then, and actually at one point we were talking about possibly making a record together. But
sure, that'd be awesome.
But things kept changing, and you know the scheduling kept slipping, and so she doesn't make a whole lot of records anyway. She makes one every maybe 5 years.
So, some of your other tracks, Bleep with Joe Walsh. To me, that sounds very Brian Wilson. Like a
Beach, it does have a Brian Wilson thing, and it's not something that either of us set out to create. It just kind of came out that way after it was done.
Mm-hmm.
Joe sent me, he had this track that he had never been able to finish. He'd never been able to figure out what the words and the exact melody were going to be like. So he sent that to me.
Right.
And I kind of stripped it down and made the guitar part that he plays the focus of it, because it had a whole kind of drum beat and stuff going on, and I took all of that out and made a different sort of song. And I think that's what gives it that kind of Beach Boys Brian Wilson character, is the spaciness in it, and then suddenly it gets really big and dense at a certain point with lots of vocals in it. But it wasn't as if I was consciously setting out to, you know, make a that kind of a song. It's just stood back after it was done and said, whoa, that's a Brian Wilson song. How did that happen?
Oh, you got some Beach Boys in you. So what?
Yeah, that's in there.
Yeah.
Ideally, you know, that's, you know, what you're trying to do is you pick your influences, make sure that you have good, strong influences, and then you're supposed to hide those, you know, so that nobody can figure out. You mix them up in a way that people can't actually recognize or that they're not too obvious.
Then, of course, your infamous tin foil hat with Donald Fagen. To me, it's a kind of a Frank Zappa arrangement in a way. I love that track. It is really cool.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of that, you know, with the
Zappa craziness
in it and things like that. And that was, you know, the most organic track on the record in a way, because it's the only one in which me and the other artist were in the same room at the same time when we were writing and recording the vocal. Well, Donald had lived here for a couple of years back in the early 2000s, and so we did a lot of socializing back then and a little bit of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so he happened to be here in Kauai when I was finishing up the record. We went out to dinner, and we bitched about Trump the entire dinner. And then I asked him, I said, I have an orphan track for my record, which I'm probably not going to use unless you can think of something to do with it. So I gave him the track, and he started sending me titles, one of which was Tinfoil Hat. And then we suddenly knew what we had to do after that.
It just came out.
And it was actually a cathartic experience for us. You know, it was better than doing nothing and just complaining all the time. We actually, took action in a way.
It's a great song. It's a really, really good song. I like it a lot. And but By My Tea, it kind of sounded to me like a Prince Funkadelics type of track. It was, you know,
very
funky.
Definitely was. You know,
I
had never really done anything that was kind of like trying to tribute Prince or anything. But Prince and David Bowie died, like about a year and a half ago. And it was right before I started making this record, and I began to realize, you know, this, I'm of that sort of generation of musicians where you're a little out of the mainstream. You kind of do follow your own muse, and you never know sometimes what's going to come out. And it made me a little bit self-conscious, you know, to realize that I don't necessarily have all the time in the world either.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of informed the approach that I took to the record and also the title of the record, White Night.
Right.
I realized I had to get on a little bit more of a crusade about about the music and not just kind of make the records and let them lay out there and see what happens. So I've been touring more aggressively behind it. The idea of the collaborations was a way to bring it to a larger audience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you know, the idea of, you know, directly tributing somebody like Prince was almost built into the, baked
right.
into the cake in a way.
Right. And then you finally rock out at the end with This Is Not a Drill, which is an incredible rocking song. Love it a lot.
Well, you know, you could certainly depend on Joe Satriani for that.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I wasn't sure what I was going to get from him. He was very enthusiastic about getting something to me, but I had no idea what it would be. And as with, you know, many of the contributions that I would get from other artists, I essentially took what they did and stripped it down and often rearranged it in a way. So it didn't have any of those orchestral elements, but I wanted it to be sort of like, epic in a way, like a soundtrack, not simply a guitar song, but something mm-hmm. that goes a little bit beyond that.
Yeah.
So started pushing it in a little bit more dynamic direction. And
somebody,
lo and behold, it turns out to be a big fan favorite.
I guess maybe
because it stands as, you know, the kind of the yeah. most aggressive guitar-oriented
right.
song on the whole record.
On This Is Not a Drill, the track on YouTube, somebody wrote a comment. It says, huh, no one comments because it's embarrassingly good for an old guy. I like this album. I thought that was funny.
Embarrassing, old guy.
Nobody wanted
well,
to comment
know,
like, on it because
I'm not
going
to take that sitting down.
You got to write them back.
Well, the thing is that, you know, people, you know, like, unless you're, like, out there trying to be in everybody's face all the time.
Yeah.
You know, people tend to forget that, you know, maybe you never did stop doing that.
Right.
Maybe you never did stop evolving.
Yep.
The thing is that I don't make records. I make records for myself, and that
right.
means that their success with the wider audience is always going to be equivocal in some way. Because I'm often reacting to what's out there. I don't like to repeat what there already is.
Yeah.
Although sometimes I like to draw from it. I like to, you know, I like to find new influences and things like that, but I don't want to literally repeat what everyone else is doing or what happens to be popular at the time. I'm always looking for something that's a little bit more particular to me, you know, a product mm-hmm. of my influences as opposed to just me aping something else.
Right,
and
right.
so that's always going to naturally keep you kind of out of the mainstream.
Right, yeah,
and,
true.
You know, often to get into the mainstream, the price is too high. You know?
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
you know, things go through certain phases sometimes. And, you know, I never did have a disco phase, you know, like when Rod Stewart had a disco phase, you know,
right?
Finally surrendered to disco, you know, started making records with that disco beat to them, you know. Until
yeah, you could have done
that. That wasn't popular anymore. But the danger in that is, you know, mm-hmm. you become identified with the genre that you're playing, and when that genre is no longer popular,
true.
Neither are you. So,
true.
You know, there's the danger of being, you know, trying to be too hip, you know, trying to be
yeah.
too much in the mainstream, and then people just not taking you seriously.
Well, see, that's why guys like you, because you're like under the radar, you know, but you're just over the radar just enough where you did a lot of great, you know, mainstream hits. You know, you never
well, girls
out,
like me too.
Because, yeah, of course.
Because I keep throwing those. I keep throwing those ballads in there every once in a while.
Congratulations that your Berklee commencement speech was incredible. Very sincere, very honest. It was an excellent, excellent speech. I really, really enjoyed
true.
It. It's on you.
Well, I have
that's
no idea how you're supposed to do those kinds of things. You know,
it was great.
I can go up there and talk about myself, which I wound up
right.
doing anyway, I guess, but
Yeah.
It's usually in a different context, you know. That,
right.
When people heard that I was, you know, doing a commencement speech, mm-hmm. I got so much input about, you know, about what I should say, because how important that is, you know, how important
right.
it is to give those kids, you know, hope and inspiration and that sort of thing. The problem is, this is the music business, you know.
Yeah.
And so much is like, so much in the music business can be a product of chance, you know, just opportunity. You have to be in the right place at the right time.
Right.
It's sometimes, in a way, it's like sports. You know, I have a couple of sons who have been professional baseball players, and you realize that there are 30 teams in all of Major League Baseball, and if
right.
you wanted to be position player on one of those teams, that means there's 30 of those jobs in the whole world.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how good you are, unless that guy, unless that slot opens up because somebody gets injured or retires, you're never going to have a shot, no matter how good you are.
It's a shame,
and
yeah.
That sort of reality, you know, can be kind of grim to hear after you've gone through all those years of college, you know,
yeah,
preparing
exactly.
to go out and be a success. So all I could do was, you know, kind of give them, you know, my reality and,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully impress upon them that, you know, there is a lot of just like opportunity and luck. Things that you can't just create no matter how hard you work, but you
mm-hmm.
can't lose your focus, and you can't lose hope that you eventually will have an opportunity of some kind. It's just
right.
not the same as like going out and starting at the, you know, starting at some entry level job and working real hard and working your way up until you're president of the company.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work like that in the music business.
Right. Yeah, you know, another guy, you know, Mark Bowman.
Mark Almond?
What is wrong with me?
Bowman. The English singer, right?
No, Bowman from the Turtles.
Oh, Mark Bowman. I'm sorry, I misheard.
Yeah, Mark
you.
Bowman.
Okay.
Yeah,
from the Turtles.
He actually went back to school and became a professor, and I think he got his master's degree and everything at an, you know, older age, which I was very impressed by.
Yeah, he did it the hard way.
He did it the hard way.
Well, these things are sometimes, you know, like lifetime achievement awards. You know, you
right.
live long enough, you're going to wind up with an honorary doctorate. So.
Exactly. You know, I grew up in my dad's electronics retail store in D.C. since I was a little kid. I wrote a book about it. I picked 8-track over cassette. I picked beta over VHS. And, you know, I was really blown away when the Sony Soundabout came out. Then, of course, the CD came out and the portable disc man, and only to be replaced by MP3s. If you had a format to pick right now for the best sound between vinyl and a quad sound receiver, a reel-to-reel deck, an 8-track deck, a cassette, say, with a Walkman, or an MP3 player, what would you choose? That's a crazy question,
well,
isn't it?
It's a tricky question because, you know, there are so many qualifiers in that.
Right.
A lot of people nowadays say that, you know, vinyl has a quote warmth that
right.
other formats do not have. Even
right.
though it's, you know, like a strictly electromechanical system that depends on a lot of kind of almost alchemy to make the sound work. But the thing that people have ignored, that I, as a record producer and eventual masterer of records, you know, the thing that they ignore that they're never aware of is that the sound of a vinyl record degrades immediately as you play it. From the very first time you play it, the sound begins to degrade. And I'm not even talking about the dust and cat hair that gets on it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the fact that at the outside of the record, you've got so much real estate to put the sound on. But by the time you get to the inside of the record, you're talking about like half or less of the,
yep.
of the amount of real estate to put the same amount of sound on.
Right.
So obviously the sound at the end of the record is worse than the sound at the beginning of the record.
Right.
But, you know, you're ignoring that for some reason because of the, quote, warmth of it.
Yep, yep.
So, you know, that's the problem with vinyl records, you know, and that's
right.
a problem that cannot be solved. You could say in that particular sense that there was more continuous fidelity on a wax cylinder, you know, because it's the same amount of real estate all across the cylinder, you know,
uh-huh.
and the fact that they did flat disc, you know, essentially ensured that the sound was going to degrade. Okay, that's one format. Okay, let's move on to tape formats. Tape as well degrades, but in a different way, and sometimes more catastrophically, like when you stick it into the player and the player eats the tape.
Yeah. So, it happened to me a lot.
So there's that issue, along with the other issues, you know. Tape,
yep.
you know, cassette tape fidelity, everyone knows that's kind of like the crappiest format that ever was.
Right.
And comparable to that, of course, is A-track. And the
yep.
issue that you had with A-track tapes was that you might have it might have to switch direction right in the middle of a song because you had to
mm-hmm.
divide what essentially was two sides. You turn it back into one continuous side and then divide it up
right.
into four equal portions, you know.
Right.
So it might change direction right in the middle of a song. So it would suddenly drop out. You know,
yep.
you're getting into the song, and it suddenly drops out right in the middle of
yep.
the song. So, you know, moving on from that, you have to say we're getting into the digital realm. And
yep.
then the question becomes, you know, was the original standard, was there enough resolution in the original standard to compensate for, you know, these fidelity issues, so-called
mm-hmm.
warmth issues? And early on in CDs, yes, they were flawed because they didn't have things like aliasing and stuff like that, and there wasn't enough. You couldn't cram enough information into 16 bits
mm-hmm.
so that you wouldn't hear at the very end of, let's say, like a track where the echo was trailing off, where you wouldn't hear it suddenly drop off like somebody
right.
had cut the tape.
Yep.
So there were issues early on with digital formats, but what digital formats did eliminate, and what they also bring to the process, they eliminated any kind of time deviation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the length of the song was exactly the length of the song.
Right.
In any
right.
of the previous formats, you had a little knob on your turntable to adjust the speed of it.
Right.
So you would try and get it as close to the original speed, but it would never be exactly the original speed.
Yeah.
And the same thing because of wow and flutter and anything that was, you know, using audio tape. You could never be assured that the song was exactly a certain length.
Right.
And so once we went to digital, we knew exactly how long the song was.
True.
Because it was
True.
Always exactly that long. And that meant that in terms of the recording process, let alone the playback process, suddenly we were in a whole new realm, you know, where you didn't have all of these issues about trying to sync up analog devices anymore. Digital devices
mm-hmm.
were always in sync.
Right.
And so that, you know, was a big boon to the making of records, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, you know, people are resigning themselves to the fact that digital is probably going to be the delivery system, so we'll address
yep.
any of our issues about so-called warmth or air or any of those other subjective terms by just increasing the resolution to something, you know, to like 96 hertz and 24 bits or something like
right,
that,
right,
which is pretty much where records are all mastered at. Now, the irony of that is that majority of the audience is going to be listening to the music on a pair of shitty earbuds.
Yeah.
And no matter how
yep.
good you try and make the record sound, there is no
yeah.
standard anymore.
I know.
They'll either be listening on these crappy earbuds, or they'll get Beats by Dre, which is essentially codified distortion.
Right, right.
And listen to the music
yep.
with that, you know. It
yeah.
makes it more and more impossible for you to have, like, a non-moving target when you're trying to figure out how records are supposed to sound.
Right. When I was selling the Sony Soundabout, when that first came out, it was called the Soundabout, not the Walkman. Then they
oh,
came
the
out
Walkman,
with a thing.
Yeah.
Then he came out with a thing called the Budokan. I don't know if you remember that or not. It was like a really high-end soundabout.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, well, you got to see all of those things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wish I kept one of each, store. Through the years. But, the sound to me was much better with that than it is on an MP3. Now, I haven't heard the Sony version of the MP3 portable Walkman. They have a Sony Walkman MP3 player, and they got one that's like $1,000 or something like that. I haven't heard that yet, so I'm wondering.
Well, the problem
if that sounds
with
like...
the MP, are you talking about the mini disc? I remember they came out with a mini disc thing, which was a magnetic device, and
right.
it was kind of like storage disc used for computers.
Right.
But all of those things had space limitations, and so whatever
right.
the music
right.
was, it was going to be compressed down to fit mm-hmm. into that, and that's where all the damage comes in.
Yeah.
But, the MP3 format, it was also sort of a moving target, and improvements over time on that format and also other formats like AAC, the MP4 mm-hmm. format,
right.
have, compensated for a lot of that problem because... In the old days, it was of kind of a brute force compression process, that was, isometric across the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
If a song 1 minute of audio got compressed into exactly like I don't know how many bytes or whatever. But after a while, they realized, you have to be a little bit more flexible, and also there are all these issues of psychoacoustics involved. What your brain does when it interprets sound. And
right,
the more
right.
we began to understand that, the better the algorithms got in terms of mm-hmm. of compression. So nowadays, if you're willing to commit the bits to it, you can compress something down to something ridiculously small and it will sound like crap.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
When you get up to, say like a 10-to-1 compression ratio, it'll sound pretty good, and the average person,
right.
as I say, will not be able to tell the difference because of what they're using to listen to it with.
Yeah, that's true. Everyone's listening on their phones, on their
this gets to be that now, when you're just listening on a tinny little speaker, or it could be these, a little mono Bluetooth speaker
right.
that you listen to in the shower. The thing about music is it's music.
Right.
And for the most part, people evaluate the sound quality of it last.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that people pay attention to is the song. Is this the song I want to listen to?
Yeah.
Second thing they pay attention to is, do I believe the way that the performer is delivering the song? Is it convincing to me, very last thing people evaluate is the sound quality, because most people have no reference for that. The way it sounds, the first time they hear it, they think that's how you intended it to sound.
Yeah, that's a shame, because it used to be number one, the sound quality,
I don't think it ever was, It always was for people.
Yeah.
It always was for people on the industry side. You want records to sound as good as possible. But,
right.
you had no control over how people would listen to it.
I mean,
when mono went to stereo, probably half the people that set up their own systems had their speakers out of phase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they get no bass out of anything,
I just remember the first thing we did when you bought a new car is change your speakers, and get the best speakers possible. And, when you want a system in the house, you got the rack system and the best, amplifier,
My dad built his own hi-fi, but that was a hi-fi. It was mono, speaker. It didn't even have a tweeter.
Todd, I know we got to break this up. One last question. Have you tried Jesse Colin Young's Morning Sun Kona Coffee? Because, that's from Hawaii.
Well, that's over in another island. It must be kind of a limited batch or something like that, because
mm-hmm.
over here in Kauai, just the other end of the chain, I don't know that I've ever seen coffee with Jesse Colin Young's face on it. Although I'm not sure what he looks like now. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I know Jesse. He's a good guy. We talk from from time to time. And you can buy his coffee right online, as a matter of fact, from his website.
Yeah, maybe I just wondered, I should do that.
Yeah, it's, I guess, made right there in Hawaii. I forgot what island he's on, but...
Yeah, well, I think he's on the Big Island. Kona
is, he on the Big
Kona
island?
Is on the Big Island, so if he lives on his own plantation, then he's over where the volcanoes are.
Todd, thank you so much for being on the call today, man. I really appreciate it. It's always great talking to you.
And, my pleasure. Good
luck on all three tours. And,
terrific,
you know,
all three.
I hope to catch you again when you come back with the White Knight Tour again.
Terrific. We'll see you then.
All right, Todd. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Todd Rundgren, very special thanks to Paul Maloney of Manasseh Entertainment for arranging this interview with Todd Rundgren. Also, Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly, Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at raypublicityworksagency.com. Please purchase Todd Rundgren's latest release, White Knight, available now at amazon.com. Find out about all of Todd's tour dates, all three tour dates, at www.toddrundgren.com. And also visit Todd Rundgren on Facebook, www.facebook.com/Todd Rundgren. And please don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's. It's the true story of an eclectic American family and their wacky family business. Or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C. Available now at Amazon.com.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.